You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
By way of introduction, we are seeing Moses in a new light here in chapter 17. He's facing a new challenge, not the challenge of being overstimulated and wild and everything has gone crazy, you know, the 10 plagues and so forth, the Pharaoh, parting of the Red Sea. Now he is facing the challenge of how to lead thousands of cranky people through a desert with all of their various needs and dangers and their grumbling, their criticisms. We've been seeing this come out, and we've even been seeing Moses' personal anger issue coming to the forefront here. This is wearing on him. It's the trial of the mundane. And how was it that Moses was able to lead God's people in the desert for several decades? He did this, I'm going to ruin the story, he does this for another four decades. And how does he do it? Well, he learns several lessons right here in chapter 17 and 18. We pick up in verse 8 of chapter 17, the Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. That's where we left off last week. And if you remember, the Israelites had crossed the Red Sea, went down to Marah, to Elim, and then to Rephidim. They're going south in the Sinai Peninsula at this point, trying to get to Mount Sinai in particular. And the Amalekites, who live in this particular region of the Sinai Peninsula, begin to attack. These are distant relatives of the Israelites through Esau, not Jacob. And now they're coming in to attack the Israelites. Real bad. These people are wicked, evil. I know in our postmodern culture, we don't like to say things like that. Oh, that's a wicked people group. Okay, if a person can be wicked, like a Jeffrey Dahmer or a Ted Bundy, he's wicked. Okay, this people group, they were depraved. We read in Deuteronomy 25, never forget what the Amalekites did to you as you came from Egypt. They attacked you when you were exhausted and weary, and they struck down those who were straggling behind. They had no fear of God. So the Amalekites didn't want to take an all-out affront against the Israelites, perhaps because they were smaller in number. I don't know. But they went around and tried to pick off the old. They picked off the old and the kids and the weary, the thirsty, the dehydrated. For what purpose? They were just wicked people. And so we read that Moses said to Joshua, choose some of our men and go out there and get those Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands. So Joshua may have been thinking, I'm going to go, and you're going where? You're going to take your staff on the hill. So I'm going to go fight, but you're going to take the staff on, just to get that straight, Moses, you're going to take your staff on the hill, and I'm going to go fight with the swords, and people are going to try and club me. But you're going to be on the safe on the hill. Okay, just want to make sure we're on the same page. Takes the staff with them. We've seen this staff before, haven't we? This was the same staff that God used to swallow up the serpents of Pharaoh's magicians, to turn the Nile River into blood, to strike the land, to bring the plagues, to separate the waters of the Red Sea. And this is the staff, the same staff that Moses is taking up on this hill, overseeing this valley and this battle. So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands with the staff, the Israelites were winning the battle. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. So Moses would lower his arms, though, and then the Amalekites would win, and then he'd push it back up into a military press. He's an 80-year-old man at this point. And then the Israelites would win, and then he would lose it, and then back and forth. And the battle was won or lost based on whether or not Moses could keep that staff up in the air. He was growing tired. So they took a stone, and they put it under Moses so that he could sit down. They're like, buddy, you're 80, okay? Sit down before you fall down. Aaron and Hur held his hands up, one on one side and one on the other. You have any idea? Even for, you know, a strapping Adonis like myself. To hold up a staff over your head for several hours. You know how hard that would be? This guy's 80. He must have been cut. But the other guys, they're there, the old men. Aaron, he's 83. I don't know how old Hur is. He comes up later in the narrative. He must be old. three old guys standing there helping each other out, trying to keep the staff up in the air. As a result, Moses' hands remained strong until sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this down on a scroll as something to be remembered, and make sure that Joshua hears it, because I will completely blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven." The Amalekites wanted to completely blot out the Israelites from under heaven. We read in Psalm chapter 83, verse 4, that the Amalekites and these other people groups were trying to, quote, wipe out the Israelites. Yet God said, "If anyone blesses you, I will bless you," or bless them. "And if anyone curses you, I will curse them." And so God is saying, they're trying to blot you out, I'm going to blot them out. And God was true to his word. You ever met an Amalekite? I never have. You ever met a Jewish person? I've met many. A lot of my close friends in high school were Jewish. We still have them today. They're still around. 3,500 years later, Amalekites, they're toast. They're gone. Just like God said. Moses built an altar and called it, "The Lord is my banner," he said, "because hands were lifted up against the throne of the Lord. The Lord will be at war against the Amalekites from generation to generation." Yes, this went on a year later. Numbers 14, the Amalekites came back under Saul 400 years later. King Saul, they came back again. These are the Edomites all the way into the time of Malachi. This was an ongoing battle. Eventually, God said, "I will take these people down from generation to generation." Let's stop right here at the end of chapter 17 for a moment. What are we supposed to learn about how God works through human persons? This is what theologians refer to as human agency. To be a human agent is for God to use your agency to impact other people. And according to the Bible, God is sovereign. One of the most misunderstood terms in all of theology. Nobody seems to know what it means. God is sovereign. What it means is he owns everything in the universe, and whatever he chooses to do, he does. Now, some of that choice of God could be to give people genuine libertarian free will. If he was any less than sovereign, as one theologian put it, he wouldn't risk giving people freedom of the will. A God less than sovereign wouldn't risk that. The sovereign God of the Bible owns everything, chooses to do whatever he desires, accomplishes whatever he wants. But what is it that he wants? What he wants is to give people genuine human agency and freedom. How is it that he works through these people? Well, it's not very sexy. Number one, God works through weakness. We see with Moses, he's 80 years old. He is past his prime at this point. You would expect a young man to be as a part of this fight and leading these people. This is a young man's game at this point to lead, you know, an innumerable amount of people out of Egypt and through the Sinai Peninsula and eventually up into the promised land of Canaan. And yet God waits 8 decades for Moses to begin leading for him. He is weak at this point. He chooses a weak man. He also chooses a dead piece of wood. You know, we're going into battle against who? The psycho, wicked Amalekites. What are they like? What do you mean, psycho, wicked? Well, they're picking off the old and the young and the weary. They're wild. They're nuts. Okay, what do we got? We got some kind of like awesome catapult or, you know, bows or arrows, maybe like a nice sword, sharp, anything, a club. We got a staff. We got the staff. We've got a dead piece of wood. That's what we've got on our side. And for some reason, God likes to use things like this. God only knows why. Apparently, God's power is more manifest in things which are weak. You know, if you broke out of prison, you know, using C4 and a knife and a gun and whatever, you know, that'd be pretty cool, I guess. But if you broke out of prison, you know, with just like, you know, a paper clip, a piece of gum, you know, and a gum wrapper, you know, if you could somehow do that, that'd be like, whoa, how did you break out of prison with a paper clip? You must be really awesome. Like if you use a really little weak, dinky little paper clip to break out of prison, you must be incredible. And when we look at this, we're like, he used a dead piece of wood? That's what he used? He must be awesome. He used an 80-year-old man. He must be awesome to be able to do that. And also, what's the secret sauce here? Moses just has to have his hands in the air. Do you have any idea how stupid he must have felt standing there for hour on end, just like, okay, we're winning again, but God, my deltoids, oh, they hurt. Like, just, it didn't feel like you're doing much minute by minute, hour by hour. It doesn't feel like a lot. You're holding up that staff, and it just doesn't feel, am I even making an impact? All of this, of course, is a picture of intercessory prayer. It doesn't say that he was praying. Of course, Psalm 63 says that when people prayed in Israel, they would raise their hands. I would just say that what God is doing here is showing that it was a life or death consequence as to whether Moses was going to lift the staff or not. And this was his way of showing, if you are going to step out in faith, then we're going to win this battle. And if you don't, people are going to die. And the same thing is true with prayer. When you sit there in prayer, you don't feel like you're doing much. Sitting here, what am I doing? I should be doing something important. And yet here we see Moses was doing the most important thing he ever could do. Way more important than anything else. And when we sit down to pray, we need to get that thought out of our head. I need to do something important. You are doing something important. You are praying. And you're going through and lifting up the people in your life, releasing God's power. What else do we learn about how God works through people? Number two, God works through human agents. Moses had a role. When his arms were up, they won. When they were down, they lost. That's human agency. That's what we're seeing here. People who say, well, I guess it just doesn't really matter if I have a role or not. God is sovereign. I guess, you know, whether I show up tonight or not, you know, what does it really matter in the scheme of things? Whether I participate tonight or not. You know, like this room right here. We just sent a whole cadre of people into the adult ministry. That's why we're seeing some empty seats. Now we've got this opportunity for people to participate, to share, to comment, to pray, to be a part of this meeting. Yet we could be sitting here thinking, yeah, but there's still a lot of people here. What does it really matter if little old me shares or participates? What does it matter if I show up tonight to give out and serve? That is false. You do have a role, an indispensable role that God is going to use. So did Joshua. I don't believe that Moses, if he had just held up that staff, they would have won that battle. He also needed Joshua to do his part. In the same way, when I go and pray for my buddy, he's got to go through and follow through. He's got to go out there and actually start to live by faith. And I'm going to pray, but I can't pray to make him do something. I can pray that the doors will be open, that he'll have courage, but he has to play his role too. And so did Aaron and Hur. Just think of this picture here. Guys at the end of their lives, so to speak, and yet they're all huddled together trying to help each other. Oh, such a role. What if Aaron and Hur weren't there to help Moses lift up that staff? Number three, God works through training others. Here we see the introduction of a very famous biblical figure. I'm speaking, of course, of Joshua. He has an entire book named after him. He's all throughout the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. He's all throughout. He's called Moses' assistant. Some translations say attendant, servant. He's Moses' understudy, to speak in the words of the theater. He's there to learn from Moses. And wherever Moses would go, he'd be like, all right, Joshua, come here. Come with me. And you're a younger man. I'm going to teach you how to do this. And he would always go with Moses wherever Moses went. That's why we see him throughout the first five books of Moses. And during these times, Moses would teach Joshua how to draw close to God. At one point, we read in Numbers 27, Joshua was a man, was filled with the Holy Spirit. When Moses came down with the Ten Commandments, when Moses would come into contact with the Shekinah glory, you know, the glory of God, and it would shine on his face, he would go into a tent, and Joshua would go in there with him. And they would talk. What was it like talking with God? What was that like? Moses, you were up on the mountain. I went all the way to the brink of the mountain, but you went up. I mean, you were up there. What was it like to be there with God? And Moses was teaching him through this entire experience. He taught Joshua how to lead pretty rebellious people. We're not here yet. Exodus 32. But we're going to see fairly shortly that Joshua is up there with Moses, and they come down and they hear this clamor and din and sound, and they don't know what it is. And Joshua is a soldier. He's a general. So he says, I think I hear a battle. And Moses says, that's not a battle. And instead, it's the Israelite people worshiping the golden calf. And that was Joshua's lesson right there, right to see how Moses would handle that situation. He taught him leadership. He also taught Joshua to grow in his faith. When we get to Numbers 14, Moses handpicks Joshua and Caleb and some other spies. And he says, go check out the land. We're going to go into that land, right? God promised it. He's given it to us. Speaking in the past tense, it's done deal. Joshua and Caleb are the only ones who come back and say, we can get that land. The rest of them, they're like, no, the guys are too scary, too big, too fearful, too frightful. Joshua and Caleb, they are on the right side on that issue. And they're the ones who actually get to go into the promised land. And that's where we get the book of Joshua from. Builds his faith, his confidence. So training others, and eventually Moses trains his disciple Joshua, his replacement, to take over. And the nation of Israel has a very bright future, as we see under Joshua's leadership. The difficulty that we see, though, is who is it that Joshua trained to replace him? Answer, Noah. And after the book of Joshua, we get the book of Judges, where everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And Joshua never trained up a replacement. Instead, there were just these sporadic judges that would pop up, and there's the cycle of crying out to God and God rescuing the people, and then it gets worse and worse and worse. It's just a spiral down, 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 until finally it's just so miserable. I don't want to ruin the ending. You got to read it for yourself. But at the end of the book of Judges, it just gets so depraved and so sick that the author concludes, everyone did what was right in their own eyes because there was no king in Israel. There was a paucity of leadership, and Joshua didn't do anything. He did a great job himself. He's a superstar. But he didn't do the job of training a replacement like Moses. Human agency, very, very important. Let's look at our second chapter, chapter 18, verse 1. Now Jethro, if you remember Exodus 2:18, he's called Reuel there. He had two different names, not uncommon in the Bible. Jethro, the priest of Midian, also the father-in-law of Moses, heard everything that God had done for Moses and for his people Israel, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. After Moses had sent away his wife Zipporah, his father-in-law Jethro received her, Zipporah, and her two sons. I can't believe the commentators and scholars who say, well, that's the language of divorce later in the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 24, you send her away with a certificate of divorce. So Moses divorced Zipporah. No, you keep reading the text. They're still married. I think she might die. They're old. But they come back together. What we're seeing here is that Moses said, all right, honey, boys, I'm about to go confront Pharaoh. And either he said to them, don't come, because it's going to be dangerous, or they said to him, we don't want to come. That sounds scary. So at this point, there are communication lines between Midian and Egypt. Jethro hears about this. The coast is clear. And he brings Moses' wife back to him. And he gets to see his two sons. Jethro and Moses, his sons and wife, came to him in the wilderness, not divorced, where he was camped near the mountain of God. So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, and he bowed down and he kissed him. They greeted each other, and then they went into the tent. Moses told his father-in-law about everything that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake. He told Jethro about all the hardships that they had met along the way and how the Lord had saved them through it all. Jethro was delighted to hear about all the good things that the Lord had done for Israel in rescuing them from the hand of the Egyptians. He's hearing these stories. The Nile was turned into what? The Nile, the big river, blood. And then what happened? Then I prayed again and it turned back into the Nile. And then what next? The frogs, brought in frogs. Frogs where? Frogs everywhere, Jethro. They were everywhere. And then mosquitoes. You should have seen the mosquito bites on these guys. And then hail, and you know, then the Red Sea, and Jethro is just like, whoa. Finally, he just breaks out. He says, praise be to the Lord Yahweh, who rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians and from Pharaoh, and rescued the people of Israel from the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all other gods. Who is Jethro? A Midianite priest. He hadn't been a believer in the one true God. He was friendly about it. You know what I mean? Moses said, I got to go on a leave of absence. You know, I know I work under you, Jethro, but I got to go and I got to go confront Pharaoh. And Jethro's like, okay, I'll pray for you. You know, good luck with that. And it's one thing to say, I got to go. I got a calling from God, but to come back. And this was the real deal. He realized God is real through what he saw. Then Jethro brought a burnt offering and sacrifices to God. This is the true God, not the fake gods we've been hearing about in the ancient Near East. Aaron came too with all the elders of Israel to eat a meal with Moses, his father-in-law, in the presence of God. The next day, Moses took his seat to serve as a judge for the people. Remember, this harkens back to, is it Exodus chapter 2, right around verse 16, who are you to be a judge over us? And here we see Moses is a judge. God has finally brought him to this place. The people stood all around Moses from morning until evening. He judged cases. You know what that sounds like? Terrible. Terrible. Dealing with people's problems all day. Moses is doing this all day. He's waking up, he's getting his coffee, the sun's rising, and then he's going out and, okay, who stole the sheep? How many sheep were there? And you were the owner? And okay, next. And they're just coming in one after another. You know, at this point, the Israelites, think about this. They've been on the run. They've got a backlog of cases. You don't bring up your sheep and donkey issues when you've been on the run from Pharaoh. But now it's like, now we do talk about it. Plus, they didn't have rights before. They were slaves. They're like, we got some rights now. I want my case to be heard by Moses. That just sounds, oh. Verse 14, when his father-in-law, though, Jethro, saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he speaks up. Moses, what are you doing? He starts to weigh in there with a little bit of questioning. Why do you alone sit as judge? You've got all these people standing around you from morning until evening. Why is it just you got to be the guy alone? What are you doing? So Moses comes back. He says, I'm Moses, man. The people come to me to see me, to seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it's brought to me and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and instructions. Don't you know this? I'm Moses. And Jethro, who's this brand new believer in God, has the audacity to turn to Moses and say, what you're doing, Moses, is not good. You and these people who come out to you will only wear yourselves out. Oh, this isn't just bad for Moses. This is bad for the people. Because think about that. I got a problem with the real estate or with some kind of legal issue, and I got to take a ticket and wait in line for a year until I can finally talk to Moses. There's so many cases being held here. By that time, the sheep are going to be dead. You know, the case is closed. I don't even know. This is not good for the people. It's not good for you. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. This is what you should do. You should continue to be the people's representative before God. Don't stop that. Bringing their disputes to God. What would that be? The representative before God, bringing people's disputes before God. That's prayer. Also, don't stop teaching God's decrees and giving them his instructions. Show them how to conduct their lives. Don't stop the teaching of the word. We shouldn't stop that at all. But instead, select capable men from all the people. See, these are the two most important things you can do, to pray and to teach the word of God. That is priority numbers 1 and 2, and I don't even know which order they should be in. So much so that the apostles in Acts chapter 6, when there's a huge fight between the Hellenistic and the Hebraic Jewish widows, they say, we need to get some good men on this because we can't get distracted from prayer and the teaching of the word of God. Now, in our context today, everybody is supposed to be able to teach. Everybody's supposed to be able to pray. We read in Numbers 11, Joshua felt a little bit jealous for Moses. He says, there's this guy, Eldad. He's out there prophesying. Should I stop him? Should I put the squeeze on him? Moses says, no, I wish that all God's people would actually prophesy and teach. Oh, that was prophetic in and of itself. Because now every single person is supposed to teach one another with all wisdom and instruction. Colossians 3, verse 16. At this point in history, however, they didn't even have a Bible. Very nascent Bible, Exodus 17, 14, right? Write it in a scroll. It's just writing down what's happened so far. That's all they got for a Bible. And most people were illiterate. So who's going to be the Bible teacher? It's either Moses or Moses. Those are the two people that could do it. Prayer, individual prayer. Not well taught in the Old Testament. Not well taught. How do we do it? It's shown to us in the Psalms. We see examples from Daniel, Nehemiah, but we're never told how to do it individually. Moses seems to know how to do this. And so to pray and to teach, we should not neglect this. Instead, he says, select capable men from all the people. Pick men who fear God, who are trustworthy, and who hate dishonest gain. Appoint them as officials over thousands and hundreds and fifties and tens. So don't just pick whoever. Pick good leaders here. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring the difficult cases to you. So you still have a role here. Just don't do it all. The simple cases, they can decide themselves. They will make your load lighter because they will share it with you. If you do this, Moses, and God so commands this, you will be able to stand the strain and all these people will go home satisfied. Moses listened to his father-in-law, and Moses did everything that he said. He chose capable men from all Israel. It made them leaders of the people over thousands and hundreds and fifties and tens. They served as judges for the people at all times. The difficult cases they brought to Moses, but the simple ones they decided themselves. And we conclude, then Moses sent his father-in-law on his way, and Jethro returned to his own country. What do we learn here from chapter 18 about leadership from Moses? For one, Moses learned to delegate. I say that word, and many of you just initially pull in, scrunch up, oh, I hate that word, delegate. To release control to other people. They don't know what they're doing. You know, they don't know how to do this as well as I can. You know, this is what Moses must have been thinking. I'm Moses. I talk to God face to face, Exodus 33. I get the decrees of God. And I'm supposed to entrust God's decrees to these knuckleheads out here to be in charge of thousands and hundreds and fifties and tens. That's what you're telling me to do? That's exactly what God's telling you to do. It's not good to burn yourself out from morning until evening. That is not good. Well, I'm serving the Lord. I'm so glad to hear that. And you know, the Bible teaches to expend yourself for Christ. God doesn't feel good when you lay your head on the pillow after a long day of serving the Lord. God, does that feel good? Giving your life away to other people. Driving people, encouraging them, building them up, teaching, whatever. And you lay down at night, oh, does that feel good? And that's God's will for your life, is to labor and strive with the energy that he provides. I have no issue with that, with doing that. I have an issue with overdoing that. To the point, how would you know if you were overdoing it? To the point where you yourself are breaking down. You're doing so much that it's exhausting, it's not good. It's too heavy. You can't handle it. But in your arrogance and your pride, that must be what it is. It has to be what it is. In your pride, you're saying, I'm the only one who can do this. Why else wouldn't you give somebody else a shot? Let them have a shot at serving. Why was it that Moses was able to live to 120 years old? He had 40 more years of service in him. Why is that? This is why. Because he didn't run himself ragged. He was able to run a race. For a very long time. What we see from Jethro is pretty wise. Moses is looking at these people. Their problems. God, I hate people. With their issues. And they're always arguing, fighting. You know, bickering, critical, and grumbling. And Jethro is like, so what's your problem? Moses, well, that's the problem, is these freaking people. And Jethro looks at the problem and he says, Moses, that's not your problem. That's your solution. The people that are grumbling, the people that are the issue, go to those people and get from those people, people that can help lead the people. And so when we feel the sense of being overwhelmed, one of the things we should stop and do is pause and say, how can we start to turn this problem actually into the solution to the problem, where they can actually start to pick up an oar and start to help out with this work? Very, very insightful from Jethro. You could tell he's a very good leader. Wish he would have stuck around. He went back to Midian to practice worship of God. He probably would have been a good consigliere to Moses, but he takes off. Anyways, number two, Moses didn't over-delegate. See, that's what happens. See, some people are so controlling. They got to do everything themselves, and I got to do it all, and I got to decide it all, and fix it all, and do it all. And then, but then they're like, okay, but I'm burned out, so I need to delegate. So what they do is they're like, I'm not going to do anything ever again. I'm going to give it to everyone else. And so anyway, you, what's your name? I don't know your name, but can you handle it? And just everything is just being just spread all over the place, over-delegating. That's worse. Great job. You just completely screwed up. And so then people are like, well, I'm never going to delegate again. Okay, don't delegate the important stuff, the stuff that only you can do. In this case, for Moses, that was prayer and teaching. Today, that's not true of us. You can never say, well, I'm the one who gets to teach in every week or whatever. Well, no. Other people should be able to get in there. Other people should be able to serve. Okay. At this point, that was something only Moses could do. If somebody else can do the job that I'm doing, why not let them step in? Well, they might not be as good. I wasn't as good when I took over from somebody else. But thank God we're not so tight-fisted that we need to stay wrestled to the captain's chair all the time, but we're letting other people have a shot. Over-delegating would be choosing lousy leaders. So would you be responsible for this? Yeah, they don't have a clue what they're doing. You hand it over, it actually turns into more stress when you hand things over to a person that's irresponsible. This is why people pull back from delegation, because it just would have been easier if I would have done it in the first place. No. If you had picked a good person in the first place, your problem was your lousy discernment and wisdom that you picked a foolish person to do this. You should have picked her, not him. He's a dope. He doesn't know what he's doing. She's sharp. She knows what she's doing. If you had chosen a quality leader, this would have been great. And maybe you got to do a little bit of training, not that much. And now this person is going to take off like a firecracker. Moses reserved the hardest cases for himself. See, he didn't just dump these on other people. See, that's being cowardly. That's being avoiding, where this is really serious, really scary, and I don't want to deal with it. So I'm going to, in the guise of a delegation, I'm going to let somebody else go in there and take the issue. No, we need to still deal with these issues in our own service for Christ. However, other issues, why can't we let it go? Why can't we let other people get involved? Delegation, over-delegation. And finally, our lesson on leadership for Moses is humility. Humility. Moses needed to admit for himself and all the people that he, quote, could not handle it alone. You know how hard it is to say, hey, you know, talking to other people, I need help. You need what? Don't make me say it twice, okay? I can't do this by myself. I need help. That puts you in a very humble posture to admit, would you help me? And not complain. See, that's what a lot of people do. They complain. You know, I'm doing all the work around here, and I'm doing this and that. Nobody else helps. You've never asked. You've never asked. All you've done is made people feel small, make people feel lousy about themselves, judging. You've never asked. You need to ask people for help. Would you help? Finally, Moses listened to a brand new believer in God, Jethro. Moses didn't pull the thing where Jethro gives him this nice idea, and then he says, you know, I'll think about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I need to pray about that some more. But Jethro, you know, maybe when you get a little bit wiser like me, you know, maybe you'll see things differently. I don't know if you really got the nuance perfectly on that, Jethro. Like, the way you said that to me wasn't quite right. Like, I don't think you really understand thousands and hundreds and fifties. We're really not even broken up into groups like that. He didn't nitpick everything that Jethro said. What he did is he listened and he followed what he said. Now, I could qualify that to death. You know, it's not that Jethro said jump and Moses said how high. Moses heard a good word from his father-in-law, and he heard that and he said, he's right. and I'm wrong. It doesn't matter about the source of the advice. What matters is the merits of the advice. So I can hear feedback from the youngest Christian in the room. Does not matter. The question is it true? Do I need to hear that? Well, let's wrap up with a few questions here. Okay. It's okay to be weak. Seems like God is okay with that. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, God says that he's chosen the weak things of the world to shame the strong. I don't get it. But for some reason, God likes to work through weak people like us. It speaks something about his character when people see weak people, broken, fractured people, and they see them doing miraculous things, having changes of their entire lives. That's okay. God's okay with weakness. But the question is, are you trying? Are you trying? You know, Moses could have stood up there and said, God, I'm 80. I can't lift this over my head for hours. Instead, he tried. He failed. The staff kept coming down, and he tried some more, and he kept failing. And they said, sit down. Okay, and then we'll help you. But we'll help you. But are you trying? Are you trying and failing? Or are you just saying, I'm too weak, I'm too broken, I'm too screwed up, I would blow it, I'm too nervous, I'm too inhibited, I'm too insecure, I'm too introverted, I'm too extroverted, I'm too whatever, I could never do that. That what that's saying is you're giving excuses like Moses was doing in Exodus 3 and 4. That's all that is. It's okay to be weak, but are you trying? Do you value your role? Or do you devalue your role when it comes to human agency? I'm sure if I don't show up tonight, it's not really even going to matter. Yes, it will matter. 1 Corinthians 12, verse 21 says that the eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. You say, well, you're saying God needs me? No, I'm saying I need you. The eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you. We need each other. We need each other. Not God. God doesn't need me, but we need each other. Do I value that role? Do I think it's important? Is it hard to ask for help? When was the last time in recent memory you remember very specifically asking somebody, hey, I can't do this. I need help. I'm burned out. Can you help me? You know, and I don't just mean some kind of a bank shot. I mean, talking to somebody straight up, I need some help here. Finally, who are the people in your life, like a Jethro, who gives you advice? And when was the last time you took their input? We hear people say, you know, yeah, I took the advice, but then they never do anything. They nod complacently, yeah, good idea, never changes. Or people are always, you know, hypercritical of what people say. What we need to do is, almost like a miner, dig through all of the coal and the dirt and the rock until we can find, in what people are sharing, that one piece of gold. Okay, I know there's a lot of stuff in here that they don't understand. Who cares about that? What I'm going to do is find the one thing I needed to hear. If they had the courage to speak up into my life, I want to honor that by trying to find out what nugget is in there that God has for me. When was the last time you listened?
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.